So this is, what I want to do is read the translation of the previous verse, because this verse is referring to the previous verse. So the previous verse is 10th Canto, chapter 4, text 13, translation. After speaking to Kamsa in this way, the goddess Durga, Yoga Maya, appeared in different places, such as Varanasi, and became celebrated by different names, such as Annapurna, Durga, Kali, and Bhadra. Actually, I want to read the verse before. It's referring, 14 is referring to text 12. So this is what Durga said, to remind you, or if you weren't here. O Kamsa, you fool! What will be the use of killing me? The Supreme Personality of Godhead, who has been your enemy from the very beginning and who will certainly kill you, has already taken his birth somewhere else. Therefore, do not unnecessarily kill other children. So today's verse refers to this verse and previous verses in which Durga Devi was trying to speak some sense into Kamsa. Translation. After hearing the words of the goddess Durga, Kamsa was struck with wonder. Thus he approached his sister Devaki and brother-in-law Vasudev, released them immediately from their shackles, and very humbly spoke as follows. Purport. Kamsa was astonished because the goddess Durga had become the daughter of Devaki. Since Devaki was a human being, how could the goddess Durga become her daughter? This was one cause of his astonishment. Also, how is it that the eighth child of Devaki was a female? This also astonished him. In other words, it's supposed to be Krishna, right? So there was a change-up. And this is, imagine your sister gave birth to Durga. You just thought she was your sister. But now, rethinking, who is this sister of mine that could give birth to Durga? So that's how he's thinking. Asuras are generally devotees of Mother Durga, Shakti, or of the demigods, especially Lord Shiva. The appearance of Durga in her original eight-arm feature, holding various weapons, immediately changed Kamsa's mind about Devaki's being an ordinary human. Devaki must have had some transcendental qualities. Otherwise, why would the goddess Durga have taken birth from her womb? Under the circumstances, Kamsa, struck with wonder, wanted to compensate for his atrocities against his sister Devaki. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So, when I read this verse this morning, the first thing that struck me, a couple things, was here it describes Kamsa as being humble. He humbly approached his sister. And it also says here that Kamsa is repentant. And it's quite interesting that a person who has done so many atrocious things could, number one, all of a sudden become humble, and then also become so repentant. It's like completely out of character, it seems, doesn't it? If Kamsa apologized to you, would you trust him based on his track record? Probably not. I don't advise you to. And as we will learn in the coming verses, he again did a change up. Because his advisors didn't think it was such a good idea that he treat his brother-in-law and sister this way. And they gave him some very bad advice, and he took it. Anyone know that bad advice? Really, really, really bad advice. It doesn't really get any worse than this. His advisors said, kill all the children, kill all the Brahmins, kill all the cows. And in the purport there, Prabhupada said his advisors were fools, and he listened to them. And what does that mean if you listen to a fool? What does that say? Not too much about you. So, later in this chapter, another interesting thing happens, that Kangsa speaks to his sister. Doesn't speak, actually he preaches to her, and he says, actually, you know, the body is temporary and the soul is eternal, so even though your children have been killed, you should not lament. And not only that, we all have our karma, so this must have been destined. So now Kamsa is this big philosopher. Quite an interesting character, right? Multifaceted. A sadhu, a philosopher, a demon, all housed in one form. And you also find an interesting phenomenon in Bhagavatam. Hiranyakashipu did the same thing. He spoke about the immortality of the soul. And he is considered the greatest of demons. Now, there's a couple of interesting points here. Prabhupada makes the point that even though these persons were so demoniac, because they lived in Vedic culture was an enlightened culture, so even the demoniac people are enlightened. Right? And you may find people today who are not comparable to having the demoniac qualities of persons like Kamsa, but they don't have the knowledge. So even so-called high-grade people, in terms of knowledge, are low-grade. And in Vedic culture, low-grade people, in terms of knowledge, were high-grade. Interesting, isn't it? So that's why you'll find this seemingly paradox. This seeming paradox that these asuric persons who have no gumption in killing innocent babies, cows, Brahmins, and so forth, can speak such high knowledge. It also brings up another interesting point. A person can have knowledge and can have bad qualities. That's what we're seeing here, right? You could know something and have very bad qualities. And that's relevant to us because we know a lot. We have 50 books of information, don't we? We have more than 50, actually. We know a lot. If you live as a brahmachari, you get the luxury, if you're in a good temple, you get the luxury that you can read every day for an hour or two. You can learn shlokas. And, you know, if you read every day for a couple hours, what, in a year or so, go through the whole Bhagavatam, or 1 or 2 years, isn't it? Vaisheshika has a formula. How many pages you read a day to get through the Bhagavatam in 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, like that. It's not that much. Anyway, so, but if that knowledge doesn't touch the heart, then the knowledge is information, not transformation. Yes? Information stays here. It's locked here in the head. And transformation goes into the heart. So, Sanatana Goswami, when he was instructed by Mahaprabhu, after he got the instructions, he wisely asked Mahaprabhu, can you bless me so that these instructions become now realized so that I act on them? And it's very interesting that he asked for this blessing, because in the Bhagavatam, in the first canto, Prabhupada said, one of the blessings that you get from the spiritual master is that he injects you. He used this word. He injects you with good qualities. This is one of the ways Prabhupada describes how good qualities develop within us. You please the spiritual master. When the spiritual master is pleased, then by this mystical process of transference of mercy, good qualities become injected and you start to develop good qualities. Which is why we say that information without surrender to a person and service to that person, a proper representative, only remains information. It doesn't become realized. And there are many people nowadays, as you know, that have a lot of Vedic information that's floating around their head. But by character, they're not a whole lot different than anybody else. But that can also be a problem for us, because just because we have information doesn't mean it's transforming us. It may not. In fact, information can be counterproductive, because the more you get it, you can easily become proud because you think you know more than other people, even if you're not acting on it. Of course, by our definition, unless you act, you don't know. It's just information. Even non-devotees say that. You may know about something, but unless you live it, you don't know it. Yeah. Have you been to the seminar, How to Make $1 Million in a Year? Yeah, I've been there. I know all that. Are you a millionaire? No. So you don't really know it. You have information. You have the process. But if you knew it, you would be doing it. Right? Yes? No? If you know it, you do it. You live it. You become it. So, there's a saying in America, maybe it's been exported from America, or maybe it started here and got exported to America, but as Americans, of course, we think everything starts there. So, there's a saying, the longest distance in the universe is from the head to the, where? What's the longest distance? From the head to India? No. From the head to the moon? From the head to the heart, that's the longest distance. To get that information into action, that's the longest distance in the universe. I like to look at it like this knowledge is trickling down. You know, I'm trying to get it from my head and trickle it down into my heart. You know, trickle. You know, knock my head, do something. Apply it. But anyway, Prabhupada has given us the formula. You please the Guru. When he's happy with you, he injects you with this realization. And we see that in Krishna consciousness. Anyway, I'd like to tell you a story. It's one of my favorite stories. And this illustrates an extremely important point for us. Something that teaches us what Prabhupada expects of us. In 1975, Srila Prabhupada traveled to South Africa. He was on a plane in which, in those days, was separated by smoking and no smoking sections. And obviously, Prabhupada was not in the smoking section. But in his section, in the non-smoking section, there were a bunch of rough rugby players, and they decided they would smoke in the non-smoking section. Because, after all, they can do whatever they want because they're superstars, right? And superstars can do whatever they want. Break the rules. So Prabhupada's servant, who was sitting next to him, called the flight attendant and said, could you please ask them not to smoke? This is a non-smoking section. So the flight attendant complied and they stopped smoking. And then later in the flight, the rough, tough rugby players decided, I can't go another moment without smoking. And they went and had another cigarette. And then again, Prabhupada's servant called the flight attendant, and Prabhupada stopped him. He said, just tolerate it. And then he said a statement that struck me very deeply. And if we remember this statement, it actually can transform us in many ways, I think. Prabhupada then said, he asked a question to his servant. He said, if you can't tolerate this, what is the difference between you and an ordinary person? What is the difference between you and an ordinary person? We could say, well, obviously the difference between me and an ordinary person is that I know 58 shlokas from Bhagavad Gita, I know 63 from Bhagavatam, I wear tilak, dhoti, kurta, kanti, I chant Hare Krishna. Okay. And Prabhupada saying, what's the difference between what you do and what an ordinary person does? The right now in that situation, Prabhupada is telling him, there is no difference. If you can't tolerate it, the question, it's a rhetorical question. It's saying, there is no difference between you and ordinary people. Now, funny story. I don't know where this took place. I think it may have been Australia. Prabhupada's servants were taking rest after lunch. And Prabhupada called them, but because they were sleeping, obviously they didn't come in, and so Prabhupada came into their room to wake them up. And Prabhupada said, why are you sleeping? And they said, we're jet-lagged. And Prabhupada didn't really understand jet lag. He said, I'm not sleeping. What is this jet lag? And then he was criticizing them that they had eaten all his leftover maha plus the regular temple prasadam, and now they're sleeping. And he said, He said, actually, you're worse than the karmis, because right now the karmis are working, but you're sleeping. It's true, isn't it? You ever thought like that? Sometimes, you know, sometimes a bad quality becomes a good quality, because if you're in the mode of ignorance, passion is up, right? So if you're lazy, then at least if you're working, that's better. We sometimes criticize the foolish mudhas who work very hard, but sometimes in the devotee community, some people are so lazy that they make the mudhas look good, right? At least if you were working, you know, responsible, you would be better. Funny, you know, sometimes we have things are topsy-turvy. Anyway, so Kamsa is a good role model for us. Why is a Kamsa a good role model? Because he personifies a person who knows so much and his heart is dirty and bad and horrible. And later on, he changes his decision because you can't trust him. He changes his decision even though he has so much information. So what do we learn from Kamsa? Or what do we learn from anybody who does something which is not right? Like often we'll see another person, especially when we see a devotee do something and it's not really what they're supposed to be doing, we get upset, right? You get upset? Sometimes, yeah. He's supposed to be doing this, and he did that, and he's been a devotee for 75 years. How can he do that? What's wrong? How could he say that? It's upsetting. You have expectations. But it is said wisely that you can always learn from the wrong actions of another person. Because by their wrong actions, they're teaching you what not to do. Aren't they? So instead of becoming upset, you can think, thank you, you just taught me what I never want to do. I never want to treat another person the way you just treated that person, because that's wrong. Thank you. Of course, you don't tell the person this, but you think, thank you for showing me. I've learned something from you. I've learned what not to do. Yes? So we're learning a lot from Kamsa of what not to do. And then the other point that comes up in this verse is a very interesting point, and it comes up a lot in discussions in Bhagavatam class. In Prabhupada, we're talking here that ultimately you can't trust Kamsa. And his good qualities, his exhibition of good qualities, are not really good qualities, because underneath it, what's going on for Kamsa is whatever he needs to do to satisfy his whims, he's going to do. Isn't it? You know that. So he's very nice. Yeah, he apologized. I don't trust this guy. Because in a moment's notice, he can flip, right? So now, this brings up the shloka. Yasyasti bhaktir bhagavata kinshana. If you have bhakti, pure bhakti, sarva guna, tatra samasate sura. You have all these saintly qualities. You have the qualities like the suras have. Harava bhaktasyo. But if you don't have bhakti, kuto mahagunan, you have no good quality. Kamsa has apparently good qualities, but this verse says, no, he doesn't. And this is a very interesting shloka, because does it really mean that no one has any good qualities? And does it really mean everyone in this room has all good qualities like the demigods, and everyone who's not doing bhakti has no good qualities? Is that what it means? Well, that's what it says. It seems to mean that, doesn't it? Now, Prabhupada explains this verse in different places in his purports. And he says it doesn't exactly mean they don't have good qualities. It means they don't have saintly qualities. And then he further elaborates. It means that those good qualities that they may have, and Prabhupada acknowledges in one purport, he said they may be educated, they may have good qualities due to culture, but they don't have good qualities. So it's like, what does that mean? He said they don't have saintly qualities. For example, I was giving a course in humility once, so we asked a question about when we manifest humility. So someone made a very good point. They said, sometimes in the office, you manifest humility to your boss. Your boss says, do this. Yes, sir, I will do it. Your boss says, you did this wrong. You say, thank you for correcting me. So you manifest humility. But the devotee said, actually, it's not real humility. I just want to keep my job. So I manifest humility to keep my job because I need this job. So I'm very nice. I'm very respectful. So you could say externally, this person is humble. But at the same time, you could say he's really not humble because he's just doing it to get his job, right? To keep his job and make money, which he needs to do to maintain himself. So that's the point Prabhupada's making. You see humility, but it's not saintly, it's not godly. Because humility means to be humble to who? Your boss? No. To another person? Not exactly. Because first, you have to be humble to God. So if you're not humble to God, or let's say you're an atheist, can you really be humble if you're an atheist? You can be humble in the material sense, but not in the sense that this verse describes. As humility is a godly quality, because by definition, humility means you see your position in relation to God, and you see your dependence on God. That's how Prabhupada defined humility. Dependence. I am dependent on God. That's what it means to be humble. So the humble person in the office may not be dependent on God. So his humility is considered by Bhagavatam to say, no, he has no good qualities, even though you see good qualities. He's very nice. He's very humble. He's very generous. He's very kind. Then you come to the temple, and somebody buds in front of the line for prasadam, gets the last plate, and you're left there. And you think, this devotee's not very kind. And then you go back to the shloka and say, wait a minute, it says the devotee has all good qualities. Well, that guy in the office, the other day, he was very kind. He gave me something. So now I'm confused. I'm mixed up. The word used in this verse, yasyasti bhakti bhagavata kinshana, to explain why a non-devotee doesn't have good qualities is mana rata. And mana, of course, we know means mind, and rata means chariot. And there's another verse in Bhagavatam where the word is manogatan. Oh no, it's Bhagavad Gita. Pajahati yada kaman sarvaparta manogatan. When one gives up all desires, born of mana gatan. It's called mental concoction, or mana rat, the chariot of the mind. So what does Prabhupada mean by that? This verse says they don't have good qualities because of the mana rat. And mana rat simply means they're acting on the basis of mind. And what does it mean to act on the basis of mind? Well, mind is thinking, feeling, and willing. So basically what Prabhupada's saying, how can someone who exhibits externally good qualities actually have them if their life is whimsical, when they're just acting on the impulses of what feels good in the moment, not based on Shastra or a higher principle? Because that's what the manarat means. Si si radha gokula nandakija. Okay, here's the best way we can translate manarat. The popular phrase, if it feels good, do it. That's the manarat. That's what it means. How do you feel right now? I feel like releasing Devaki and Basudeva. That's how I feel. How did you feel a while back? I felt like imprisoning them. How did you feel before that? I felt like I should kill their kids. But when they brought them to me, I thought, why kill them? It's only the eighth, so we'll let them go. But then after I consulted with my advisors, I felt like, actually, I should kill them. That's called manarat. Whichever way the wind blows, how you feel, that's how you act. Isn't it? Right? So that's why it's saying a person who lives on the platform of feeling and not basing their activities on higher principles, shastra, on devotion to God, on dharma, they don't have good qualities, even if they do, because they're employing those good qualities in what? Whatever they feel like. Isn't it? I feel like being humble because it'll be good for me. I'll get something, so I'll be humble. Now I don't feel like being humble because people will take advantage of me, so I won't be humble. So it's like that. So it's not being employed in Krishna's service. It is a good quality. We don't say it's not a good quality. I wouldn't say this person isn't humble. We don't deny its humility. It's just not a godly quality. It's actually humility being employed within the modes of nature. So that verse says, When it says they don't have good qualities, it says they don't have godly qualities because it's not connected with Krishna. Does that make sense? Otherwise, what we see with our eyes is many people who have many good qualities. And we know if somebody comes to Krishna consciousness and they're humble, it's a lot easier to be Krishna conscious, isn't it? Okay, I'm humble. It doesn't mean I'm going to be Krishna conscious. But when I come to Krishna conscious and I'm humble, it's a lot easier. The route is faster if you're humble. But still, we would say a proud person who surrenders to Krishna is in a better position than a humble person who doesn't. Right? Although potentially that humble person would have an easier time, wouldn't he? Than a proud person. I don't know if you ever read this letter, but it kind of encapsulates this principle. Some devotees were a little rough in dealing with the lady on Sankirtan, and she was so upset, she actually wrote a letter to Prabhupada complaining about them. And she was saying, they're supposed to be sadhu, saintly person, but the way they dealt with me was not at all proper. And this is not the way saintly persons act. And Prabhupada said, please excuse my disciples, they're young, they're new, they're not so refined yet. And he said, but they've given up their whole lives for Krishna. And she was saying what they did is bad. And Prabhupada said, when you give up your life for Krishna, it's never bad. So they may have done something bad. He said, please excuse me. He said, try to understand they've given their lives to Krishna, and it's not easy. So sometimes they may slip, they may do something wrong. So Prabhupada was glorifying them because they'd given their lives for Krishna, apologizing for their bad action, but glorifying them that in spite of their bad action, they've given their life for Krishna. So that's never bad. So ultimately, they're never bad. This question came up also in maybe 1972, because devotees were saying things on Sankirtan which were not 100% true to distribute a book. And so the question came to Prabhupada, can you lie to distribute a book? And Prabhupada said, if you describe Krishna, he's so unlimited, whatever you say about him will be true. You can't lie. And if you describe anything that's not true, even though it's true, that's not truth. You know, because truth is Krishna. So if you describe Krishna, that's truth. And anything else you say in the relative world, even if it's true, it's not true because it's not describing ultimate sat, truth. So it's the same idea, right? Same definition. What is real? What is the real quality of truth? You know, like some devotees say, well, you know, you have to be real. But what's the real definition of real? Sat, it's eternal. That's what's real. You have to do what's, if you want to be real, do what will bring you to the platform of eternity. That's being real. So it's so really what we're talking about here is definitions. So, okay, Kamsa in this verse, he's a good guy, he's repentant, he's humble. But actually he's not repentant and he's not humble because he's riding the manarat. He's riding the chariot of his mind, and in a moment's notice, whatever he's feeling, he'll do. And this is what we're dealing with in modern society. We're dealing with feeling as opposed to intelligence. And intelligence is lacking greatly in our society. Prabhupada's books give us intelligence. People say, they see me and they say, what do you do? And I say, my job is to help people think. People do not any longer know how to think. And if you actually read Prabhupada's books, you realize he's just teaching us how to think, how to see things. Because when you see things properly, you act properly. You see things wrongly, you act wrongly. And people don't have discretion. They need the enlightenment of Prabhupada to have discretion. So that's, anybody says, what do? So I help people think. Or I make people better, I help them think, I make them happy. One person said, don't tell them your job description, tell them the result of your job. It's more exciting. You know, you're a teacher. What do? I'm not a teacher. I'm changing the future. That's what I do. That's more exciting, right? That's what you're actually doing. So what are we actually doing? We're helping people think. We're helping people become happy. We're actually changing the world. So I will end here so we can have time for questions and comments. Thank you very much. Does anyone want to say anything? Questions, comments, arguments, debates? Yes. Yes. Yeah, they have, you could say the Dhamma devotees, it's a shadow of humility. And you could say, just because you're a devotee, you're humble, because you recognize Krishna as God. So that is a form of humility. And, you know, in chapter 13, text 8, 9, 10, 11, maybe up to 12, it lists all the godly qualities. And Prabhupada said, but unless you surrender, the other ones aren't really of any value. So humility is surrender. And so that's the whole point of this class, that one statement, unless you surrender, the others are not of particular value. You know, it's like you have a truckload of good qualities, and what are you doing with them? But when now you come to the temple and drive that truckload of good qualities to the temple, now they're all really useful. But independent of themselves, they may backfire. Like we said, knowledge can make you proud. People actually become proud of their humility. It's possible. So yes, humility is, yeah, humility is surrender. Yes. 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 What is it? Yes. So we hear that good qualities come automatically and that we should cultivate good qualities, and both things are true. And Prabhupada explains, and our acharyas explain, that everything you want to achieve, you achieve it through bhakti. So through bhakti, we will develop all good qualities. And Prabhupada simultaneously says, you have to develop good qualities, so you have to work on it. So in thinking about this, I was having a realization a couple of weeks ago, and I think this kind of encapsulates it. A lot of times, let's say, in trying to be humble, we'll maybe try to be a little less abrasive in our relationships. We'll try to maybe put a devotee in front of us and say, Prabhu, actually, I'm really not a great devotee, you are. We'll try to play the part, you know, fake it till we make it kind of thing. And oftentimes we fake it in a way that is far, far beyond our realization. And so it's completely artificial. But I was thinking that humility for us means getting along with one another. Humility for us means a devotee says, Prabhu, you know, you said this in class and that wasn't right. You know, Prabhupada said this, you said that. And I say, thank you for pointing that out. Yeah, I did say the wrong thing. That's the kind of humility we need. Not the, Prabhu, I'm lower than a worm in stool. You know, I'm really sorry that you're looking at me. I know that's contaminating you. Actually, I have a wet rag here. It's got Ganga water, you know, because you're going to need that to purify yourself after seeing me. You know, we've seen that kind of humility because you read about that in the Shastra and then you think, I'm supposed to be that way. But you can't be that way until you love Krishna. So I think maybe sometimes we miss the point that humility for us has to manifest in terms of cooperation, in terms of being able to listen to one another, take advice, take criticism humbly, and so forth. Where, you know, we walk around, I'm lower than a worm in stool, then I go outside, and then I criticize you. So it doesn't make any sense. So I coined the term, the path to humility is paved with the practice of humility. Like, so, and then, where do I get the empowerment to do the practice from bhakti? So then they both work together. Because I have to practice it, and bhakti gives me the power to do it. And then again, going back to what I spoke today, if I don't have bhakti, what's the point of being humble? So real humility will develop, but I have to activate it. Naturally, just logically, if you have an issue with anger, it's going to impede your devotional service, and you know you have to work on it. So part of the way you work on it is to improve your sadhana. And part of the way you work on it is actually deconstruct what the whole problem is and try to find out what's triggering me, what's going on psychologically, what's frustrating me, so I can work on it. And as I work on it, even if maybe material, so to speak, the fact that I want to work at it is being powered by my bhakti, because I want to advance. And then anything in relation to Krishna is spiritual, therefore my working on it is spiritual. And then by working on it, it helps my bhakti, because now I've overcome my anger. Now someone may say, well, shouldn't you be able to do it entirely just by surrender? Maybe in textbook theory, yes, but if you're not, and it's 10 years later and you're still offending devotees, you better do something about it, right? So you read a book on anger and, oh, this helped. And maybe after reading the book on anger, you realize, actually, Prabhupada said the same thing, but I didn't see it. Sometimes it happens that way. You read a book about something, you realize, actually, that's in our book, but it wasn't codified in the same way in our books or systematized. But then I realize, actually, that's in our philosophy. That's my understanding. I say the path to forgiveness is paved with the practice of forgiveness. The path to compassion is paved with the practice of compassion. You go out on book distribution, right? Why do you go out? Because Prabhupada wants you to. Is it because we're so compassionate? Not the day we move in the temple, we're not so compassionate. But the temple president says, you should go on Sankirtan because this will help people. So you go out there, it's cold, you're hungry, and your mind's saying, you don't want to be out here. You want to be in a nice warm room drinking a cup of hot tea and eating some nice buttery biscuits. But you're out there because that's what you're supposed to do because you live in the ashram. But 10 years later, you're out there because you don't want these people to suffer. So the practice of going out awakens it, right? So that's how bhakti awakens it. So you do it, and then it awakens.